This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the gig economy, the name of the game is making the nut. That's the money you need to pay the rent, the cable, your cell phone, feed the kids, and buy the health insurance you might have used to get at that 40-hour-a-week job. For more and more Americans, that's old economy. Writer and editor Tina Brown calls this the age of gigonomics, where everyone's a hustler. And whether you call these new jobs gigs, freelancing, or contingency employment, a growing number of Americans have changed the way they work, some out of necessity, others by choice. If that's you, tell us your story about how life works in the gig economy. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, why fewer bombs, less force, and increased U.S. casualties could be the future in Afghanistan. But first, Tina Brown joins us. She's the founder and editor-in-chief of the Daily Beast, where her article, The Gig Economy, appeared last month. She's with us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for coming in.
Delighted to be here.
And that terminology, gigs, the nut, a lot of that seems to come from musicians.
Yes, it does. I mean, I feel it's just such a very strong trend. And one thing I feel keenly about it is that you ask somebody today what they do, and it takes them about 10 minutes to answer because they say, well, I'm doing this consultancy, and then I'm doing this other job, you know, and then I'm speaking here, and then I'm not, and then I'm doing this. By the time they finish speaking, you think, you know, it's a whole 5 minutes has gone by without actually knowing what they do.
And it used to be, I'm in advertising.
Sure. It used to be very simple.
Yeah. And this is not just, as we've said in the beginning of the program, musicians have done this almost forever, at least most of them. I guess some of them work for Disney and work full time. But nevertheless, this is not something unfamiliar to a lot of people. It's unfamiliar to a lot of people in a lot of the fields, as you describe, that they're going into now.
Yes, I mean, of course, there's always been a very healthy freelance element to, the component of the workforce. I myself have been a freelance over the years, have been in a job for many years, but also have also been a freelance. So there's nothing wrong at all with freelancing. I think the difference is that there are people now are leaving these 40-hour jobs without any real time to kind of prepare that freelance kind of basis. And so they're pitched into this gig atmosphere where they have to kind of basically do three jobs to make the same amount of money that they were making before. And of course, this time it's without benefits. So it's a very stressful situation, really, for a great many people who always thought that a college degree was a kind of passport to a 40-hour-a-week job. Because, you know, we've seen for some time now, of course, people at the lower end of the economic spectrum have understood this for a long time, and they've done what used to be called piecework, obviously, for years, working two or three jobs at a time. What I think is new and has really come with this downturn has been the college degree, 75,000 a year and over element of the workforce, who now are having to sort of work two or three times, work two or three different jobs when they never had to do that before.
And is this age specific? It does seem to be more frequent with younger people.
It's actually quite across the board. I mean, it's really just the way it's going. I mean, again, you know, women have been quite used to this for a long time as well, because women with children, in a sense, have elected to live this way for quite a time, because they've sometimes felt that job sharing or 2 or 3 days a week is the only way they can raise their families and still kind of earn some money, but also spend quality time with their kids. Again, what is different is the fact that people are really being told by their employers, we can't sustain your salary for, you know, a 5 day a week time. We don't want to lose you, though, so we're cutting you back. We're cutting back your days. And of course, you know, this should be an absolutely fantastic thing for employers, because they should be in a situation where they don't have to pay benefits, and they've got a whole bunch of revolving people that they can call on. Actually, it's pretty discommoding to the employer too, because, you know, your workforce turns out to be this revolving cast of characters, none of whom are ever there at the time when you want them. So you call a meeting and you turn around and you say, where's Julian or where's Fred? I mean, this meeting is about his area. And they say, oh, well, this is not, Tuesday's not the day when Julian or Fred come in. You know, we can give you Francis. You know, we say, what's Francis got to do with it? And they say, well, Francis is, you know, she's in on Thursdays. So it's a kind of it's a very different new world. It can create a lot of confusion, but I think it's something we're all going to have to get used to, because my sense of it is that I don't know that we're really going to return to the sort of the old way of the old sort of structured 9-to-5, 5-day-a-week jobs for many reasons. Not only, of course, the downturn, which might well, you know, change, but because the way we live today, the expense of the health benefits, the way that companies now are so much more constantly in flux and changes happening so fast in technology and so on, it's probably going to be something that we have to get used to, and that the gig economy is actually going to become the way we just simply live now.
The standard. And don't count on the gold watch.
Absolutely. A gold watch is a thing of the past.
We're talking with Tina Brown, founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, about the gig economy. If what we're talking about describes you, give us a call and tell us about life in the gig economy. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Nicola is on with us from Auburn, California.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to comment that I have exactly this experience. My career really broke up when I had children and I decided I wanted to be home with them. And my husband was the main money earner and I did lots of different things. And in the last 2 years, I've been a wedding singer. I'm a business consultant. I'm a copy editor. I do creative writing for websites. I'm a family consultant. I teach parenting classes. And the other day, somebody, I had this exact experience that your guest said. I started to tell them what I did, and I actually started to feel embarrassed.
I think you sound like a one-woman consortium. It's absolutely extraordinary, the amount of different things that you're doing.
Well, what I did was I took some training that encouraged me to look at all the things I'd ever done in my life and basically start selling them, because my lifestyle is such and the child commitments that I have are such that even if I could get a 9-to-5, which I can't right now, I couldn't hold it down.
Well, it's very interesting. One of the things that our poll that we did actually with this piece that I wrote showed is that a lot of people in the gig economy are using one or two of the things that they've done as a hobby or a sort of part of their lifestyle to become a new way of making
money.
An income. So yeah. In the same way that if you've been really good at organizing your daughter's wedding, you can actually become part-time wedding planner because you've done it before for yourself and you prove that you were good at it.
Nicola, that might be wedding singer on your resume.
It does say wedding singer, I'm afraid.
Are you a good wedding singer?
Well, I've been told that I am. You know, one can't judge that sort of thing for yourself when you do it. But it was one of those things. I used to do a lot of musical theater. I used to actually write and direct theater in England. So when I found myself in California, I didn't have the same network, but I still had the ability to sing.
Well, congratulations, Nicola. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get... this is Zach. Zach with us from Highlands Ranch in Colorado.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm an appraiser, so I have to generate all my own business and that sort of thing from a variety of different kinds of clients. And I just wanted to say I think this is the best way that anyone, you know, can function and make a living, because you're your own boss, you set your own hours, and I think the potential for income is really only limited by yourself and your own ingenuity and innovation. And I've worked for a company before doing appraisals where it was kind of a 9-to-5 thing, and you know, I think it's fantastic to work for yourself, and I would encourage a lot more people to do that, because you know, all the corporate downsizing and things like that, you know, your potential, in my opinion, is really limited when you're working for a company, and oftentimes overlooked or even exploited. But if you're working for yourself, you know, your potential, in my opinion, is only limited by yourself. So.
Well, it's certainly true. It has a great upside once you've got over the adjustment period. And what I'm finding that, I mean, I myself went through that adjustment period when I was editing a magazine that didn't function anymore and had a period where I was literally sort of thrown back on myself. And it takes time. It takes a couple of years, really, in a way, to sort of settle into this slightly disorientating new feeling of not having that job to go to in the mornings. And I think that once you're through that period and start to understand that you have other things about yourself, which is, you know, has potential and things that you can learn to, that you didn't even think that you could do, you start to realize that you can take other parts of your own personality and experience and turn them into something that makes money. I think that can actually be a very exhilarating kind of self-growth experience as well.
I worked as a freelance for a while too, and one of the most exhilarating parts about it was the theory that you could say, I'm going to turn this job down to go to the track today. I'm just going to have a good time. I never did. I don't think I ever turned down a job, but at least in theory I could.
That's a heady feeling indeed. It can be difficult, though, to juggle it, particularly when you do have it. And the other side of childcare, of course, is that sometimes it's very difficult when you don't know what your hours are going to be. And when you have childcare booked and suddenly, the job comes up and the childcare isn't there, I think that can be very difficult for some working mothers. So there are upsides and downs to it. I think what is difficult for people is just being pitched into it without any pre-planning, because it does take time to lay the groundwork of a freelance career.
Zach, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go quickly to Philip. Philip with us from Cincinnati.
How you doing, Neil?
I'm good.
Well, what I wanted to say is that I'm a recent graduate from college. I was fortunate enough to go to the University of Maryland, and upon graduating, I have not been able to find full-time work yet. And I currently hold two jobs, one as a tutor and the other as a general laborer. But what I find is that my parents' generation kind of seems to look down on this piecemeal work. And I don't know why, if it's because, as you were mentioning before, you know, this type of, many jobs used to be done by people without college degrees. But, you know, they always ask me, well, you know, what's your profession? What's your line of work? And just as you guys were talking about before, it takes, 5 or 10 minutes to explain to them all the different things that I'm doing.
Yeah, and suddenly the idea of career, Tina Brown, career, where does that enter into it?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, maybe the word career is going to seem completely antiquated soon because the idea of a career and a career path all seem kind of somewhat passé in this really rapidly changing work world that we find ourselves in. And really, I guess we have to shed those old prejudices about, so-and-so is, a banker. I mean, let alone, God forbid, be a banker. But or so-and-so is
a lawyer.
Boy,
your parents would really disapprove of that.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, as a matter of fact, the idea of corporate loyalty just seems extraordinarily old-fashioned, because what we're seeing is that the corporations themselves have so little loyalty to the employee. Why should the employee really spend all their time wondering about how they can serve their corporation? So, all of these things have huge kind of social and economic implications and forces at large. And I think we're seeing a very rapidly changing sort of portrait of what we think of as a career.
Philip, good luck with all of your careers.
Well, thank you very much, Neil. Have a good one.
Bye-bye. We're talking about the gig economy with Tina Brown of the Daily Beast. When we come back, we'll talk with somebody who's trying to organize freelancers. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. During hard times, people adapt. Nearly 3 million full-time jobs have vanished in this recession so far. Many of those people now work independently as freelancers, contractors, or temps. If that's you, tell us your story about how life works in the gig economy. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guest is Tina Brown, founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast. She wrote the article, The Gig Economy, for that website. You can find a link to it at npr.org/talk. And joining us now is Sarah Horowitz, who is on our New York bureau. She is a founder of Working Today and executive director of the Freelancers Union. And good to talk to you, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How many people do you think are living on gigs or part-time work?
You know, it's now gotten to be about a third of the workforce. And, you know, the interesting thing is that it's been this way for many years, but I think what's starting to happen is the change in the economy, the layoffs, it's just making it clear that this is going to be the way that people will be working in the future.
And are we talking about people in a specific income bracket? Is it more lower paid people?
No, you know, that's the thing. I really agree with Tina that it's something that's happening across the board, from really low wage workers up to really high level professionals. And I think really if there's a distinction that we might be seeing is it's one of age and expectation. So when you think about people, let's say, who've just graduated from college, they didn't have an expectation that they would find a full-time job with that gold watch. Maybe it would be a digital watch, I'm not sure. And that as people have been working for several decades, and then get laid off, I think that's really where we start seeing just this huge adjustment period and it becomes difficult. But I think it really is happening across the board.
The last time we had you on the show back in November 07, you were talking about independent workers then. That, of course, before the recession hit. What's changed since?
You know, one of the things that's kind of an interesting thing that we notice is that both things are happening to freelancers. And when I say both, I mean this. Freelancers, part-timers are often the first to get laid off. It just makes sense. They're easy to just fire. But then after you've fired the rest of the staff and you start realizing, as Tina was saying, you have that staff meeting and you suddenly realize there are key jobs that need to be filled, freelancers are the ones that are getting hired back. So we just had an event last night and asked people, how are you doing? And more than half the people said they were actually doing better right now because they're picking up a lot of gigs. And that's going to be the key.
Now, freelancers getting hired back, but aren't they in a position to be exploited by employers? They're not going to get health care coverage. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to get a lot of things.
Well, yeah, you know, one of the biggest problems that we have is that our laws are still stuck back in the 1930s. So in some ways, this workforce, the career freelancer has known that it's going to be pretty rough getting health insurance, retirement. They're not eligible for unemployment insurance. They don't come under race, age, or gender discrimination laws. So what I think is significant about them is that they already have very well-established networks and are able to pick up and be nimble. I think the exploitation has been happening for a while in terms of people being misclassified. Sometimes they're misclassified as independent contractors, so they don't get benefits. And sometimes, particularly in media, people are termed W-2 employees because the companies are fearful of the IRS, and then they can't get any of the deductions for paying for their health insurance. And I think all of this, instead of, you know, one big complaint, I think what we could really do is say, we're at an exciting moment in time. We're realizing these big trends. Let's start planning for this next safety net, and let's plan into it. Flexibility, portability. Let's be imaginative and creative as people were, you know, back when Franklin Roosevelt was president.
Tina Brown, you, among other things, you make assignments to freelancers, a lot of people who write for the Daily Beast, and certainly did for your other magazines when you edited those too. And how do you respond when people try to jack you up for higher prices?
Well, you know, I've always taken the view that in some ways, when you work with freelance people, it's a wonderful way to date before you get married, as a matter of fact. And I frequently end up starting with people in freelance situations and then bringing them closer and closer in. It is a very great way to kind of get familiar with the way people work and if they're a good fit with your organization. And I think, by the way, that's true also of some of the freelancers. When Sarah was commenting that sometimes people right now feel they can be doing better, in a way, that their expertise becomes very clear when they're not there for 3 days in the week. And suddenly the bosses are saying, that person was so valuable in that meeting. What can we do? This is really aggravating that she's not here on Thursday and Friday. And they wind up being able to kind of have quite a strong negotiating position to get those extra 2 days. So it has some upside to it, I think.
You know, it's funny. I think that one of the things that I really appreciate about Tina's column is that freelancing used to be a euphemism for being unemployed. And I think
so did consultant, yeah.
And consultant, although a little joke I make is that the difference between a freelancer and a consultant is 20 years. But
or about $20 an hour, yeah.
right. Back in the old days of valuations. But, you know, I think we're really getting to a point where we have to say, freelancing is just one way of working. There's a traditional workforce, there's freelancing, and it's just as legitimate as any other. But one thing I think is a really good point that women have been doing this in raising their children and going in and out of the workforce. The downside is when you start looking at the effects on pensions and other things, that once women do leave, they don't make that up. And same with freelancing. If you're not one of those freelancers who's really able to buy and affect your own safety net, you really can anticipate kind of never retiring. And these are the problems. And it's an issue as we're looking at developing and maintaining our middle class in America.
Yeah, again.
That's right. I think there's also one other point for companies, too, which is from the other side of it, is that, you know, the whole accountability issue becomes very difficult. You know, when people are not fully vested in what they're doing, and really can feel, well, you know, Wednesdays is not my day and so forth, there can be an awful lot of things that fall between the cracks, and you can suddenly feel there's a lot less quality control when people are in and out without any full accountability.
Now let's get another caller on the line. This is Lucas. Lucas calling us from Phoenix.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to say that both of your guests are right on a lot of the concerns that I have. I there's a word for what I do, I guess. It's called the gig economy. But I have been a freelancer for about 8 years now, and I'm doing really well right about now, actually. But that does raise a bunch of concerns for me and stresses, one of them being insurance. My wife is newly pregnant. We don't have insurance and not going to be able to get it, at least not affordably. And the other stressful parts of my day-to-day life really come in, you know, for example, this weekend I was out skydiving with my niece and I'm getting phone calls from customers and they call from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. and they expect that I answer the phone. And, you know, it creates a lot of stress at home. And I was wondering if your guests have any kind of tips, you know, how can we as freelancers kind of deal with these day-to-day stresses?
It is a very difficult issue, that the feeling that you are your working life never in fact stops. There's no delineation between it. Of course,
right.
That's also true, I think, even when you have an office now with the advent of computers and BlackBerries, people tend to be continually on. I think one has to just be very firm about creating hours in one's day that really are one's hours in the day where you're just not on the radar, and simply make that clear that you have working hours. And it's hard to do as a discipline, but I think otherwise you'll go crazy with the demands pouring at you at every time. I also think the other big anxiety for people is that frequently people don't bosses in a way. They want to know something when they want to know it. So even though your days are not necessarily going to be Tuesday and Thursday, you can still find yourself suddenly half working on those days for the company that's got you the other days because, you know, they want to know stuff and you're the only guy who knows it. And I think that's a very dangerous situation for people where they really end up sort of still working more than they should for less pay.
Even more dangerous, Lucas, to log in on your BlackBerry as you're falling from the sky.
Yes. Yeah, definitely have to watch out for that.
I've heard of jobs that crater, but we really don't want to go there.
Right. That would be bad.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
And thanks very much. And let me ask you, Sarah, he raises a huge question, insurance.
Yes. And let me just say, insurance, definitely. But I think one thing also that Lucas is pointing out is that people's income is so episodic in this work life. So it's feast or famine, and people are so fearful of turning down work because they know what it's like when the famine side comes. So not only are we not seeing the boundaries that we used to, but just in taking on the work, it's so hard. And then, of course, insurance. You know, one of the things that I think is just the craziest thing about where we're at as a country is that if you're a human being in New York versus a human being in Texas versus a human being in North Dakota, you're treated just so completely differently by the different laws and regulations. So in New York, we've pioneered a way of getting freelancers health insurance that they can take from job to job and project to project, and just raise $17 million for our own social purpose insurance company so that it can be tailored to the ways that freelancers work. And I think, again, interestingly, freelancers are leading the way. They're the next architects of the safety net, and they're showing us how we need to adapt our companies, our structures. And for us, it's got to be social purpose, where the freelancers union is the owner, so that we can have our interests aligned. We want to make sure our members stay with us in the long term. So we want to make sure that their health concerns are front and center. And one of the major issues for our members are access to mental health care, alternative health treatment, and that they care about health, whereas we always are talking about fighting disease. And fighting disease, of course, is imperative, but so too is designing a system about what kinds of needs you want and need. Do you need to see a chiropractor? Do you need to see a nutritionist? All the things we know that make somebody a healthy person from a 360-degree perspective.
Let's get Matt on the line. Matt with us from Syracuse, New York. Matt, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Neil. How
Hi.
Are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
I have one problem with this freelance thing going on. I believe we're sacrificing quality for quantity. And there's people that are getting in these higher-up positions and they're splitting themselves between two and three separate jobs, and they're not doing one properly, which affects people underneath them.
Tina Brown, that's a problem a lot of people worry about.
Indeed, and I said in my piece, actually, that the snag of all this is doing two things badly, three things badly instead of one thing well. And I think, actually, I know quite a number of people in my profession, you know, which is media, editing, writing, and so on, who feel strongly that they can't ever get sort of absorbed into one thing and give it their all because they're always herring off to try to do the other thing to make the money. And it definitely does affect quality. You're actually beginning to see it in many ways. For instance, in newspapers now, you'll suddenly see a rash of typographical errors. You know, there's a lot of misspellings and missed out words. It's not a coincidence. It's because so many people have been laid off in the copy department, and the people who are left are sort of, you know, freelancers who don't really know the style of the paper and so forth, and a lot of mistakes are getting in. And so I sometimes think, well, if that's happening in newspapers with typographical errors, it must also be happening in much more scary places like hospitals or, you know, all kinds of businesses where it's pretty scary when there is something falling through between the cracks.
Tina, I'm wondering, as you're talking, do you think in part it's also that we're restructuring the way we work? You know, I think of it as we're all multitaskers now, so how do we do it to avoid those kinds of mistakes, do you know?
Well, I agree. I think that there's nothing like being fully vested, though, and caring and having that follow through to make a job be done really well. I mean, I think there are quite a number of people who would much prefer to be full time and see the thing through and really feel that, you know, it gets done to their absolute perfection. And in some ways, we're having to ask ourselves to have less perfectionism about what we do because you're not there to see the follow through.
Because it's interesting, if you ask freelancers, I think one of the things that's so striking is they have such a love of their career. You know, as you're talking about the 5 minutes and describing it, it's so much they're like the old craft workers. They love what they do and don't want to compromise it. And I wonder if sometimes it's in the structure of how we're setting up our work that it's sort of back in the old industrial time, but we're staffing it so completely differently.
We're talking about the gig economy with Sarah Horowitz of the Freelancers Union, founder of Working Today, and with Tina Brown, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Bruce on the line. Bruce from Wilmington, North Carolina. Hello, Bruce. Bruce, I think, has left us to probably go to work. and let's go to Paul. Paul with us from Louisville.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for my call.
Thanks. Go ahead, please.
I lived in Chattanooga for a year, and I was a teacher, you know, normal teacher at a school. And then had to move to Louisville to go to graduate school. And now I've kind of, with the cutbacks in funding, they're not hiring a lot of teachers. And so now I'm kind of patched together this teaching job. I guess you'd call it a gig teacher job. I'm doing some tutoring after school, doing some No Child Left Behind teaching English, and doing some editing of people's papers and some substitute teaching and kind of patching together and trying to use what I know how to do. But another issue I don't know if you guys talked about is actually, now I'm a 1099, you know, so it's a whole different tax thing that I'm having to learn, and it's getting kind of weird being now tax season. But it's kind of interesting having to patch together my job after you know having a pretty steady one down in Chattanooga.
It's a big difference between being a W-2 worker, as you described to Tina Brown, and a 1099 worker.
Well, I think it is, and I think it does take, as I was saying at the beginning, a couple of years to really know how to balance all this stuff. I mean, and unfortunately, it's one of those areas where although you can get help and support from other friends who've done it, and it's really worth talking to other people to see how they do things. You know, as mothers will tell you, raising kids, when people say, how do you do it? Unfortunately, everybody has to patch together their own funny little rag bag of solutions and shortcuts. And you do sort of start learning, you know, how to save time, how not to waste your time, how not to find yourself working for a long time for too little money because you don't quite know how to figure it out. I think all of us do that, too, when you're on these gigs, that you suddenly find you're spending 2 days on something that just isn't cost efficient. And I think people have to really look at that and say to themselves, is this really worth the money? What I'm doing. You've really got to figure out how to structure it. Each person has to do that themselves. There's no answer for it, unfortunately.
Paul, thanks very much for the call, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good luck.
And Tina Brown, one final question. You pointed out you've been a freelancer before. You've also had big-time editing jobs, including this one. Which do you prefer?
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot to say for both of them, is the truth. You know, I spent 2 years writing my book, which was one of the gigs that I did in between one of the things that I wasn't doing anymore. And the first 6 months, I found it really difficult. I really missed not only the steadiness of the job, but also the collegiality of other people being around, which is something we haven't really discussed today. But by the time I was into it in my second year, I'd really adjusted and really come to value the fact that I could work at home, that I could decide to, you know, leave the city on Thursday and work, you know, at our place, you know, out of town, that I could, you know, take a vacation with my daughter and, you know, all that kind of thing really did seem very valuable because a job is very, very constraining. So, you know, fortunately, the one thing that I was doing, writing a book, was actually able to support me in that time. But there's a lot to be said for it. And when I came back to working full time at the Daily Beast, I actually found it pretty difficult to get on those, put on that makeup in the morning and get into that car and come downtown and work in a full time job. So,
Tina Brown is the founder and editor in chief of the Daily Beast. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Sarah Horowitz, executive director of the Freelancers Union and founder of Working Today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the man who wrote the book on military tactics in Iraq, on Afghanistan.